Well, here we are again in a glamorous rehearsal studio number one here at COC. This is the sixth episode of the Big COC podcast. And I'm very happy. I'm calling this the all-blogger edition because we have three local opera bloggers here today. Two are returning panelists. First, Leslie Bartza is here today again. Hello, Leslie. Welcome.
Hey.
Good to have you here again. His blog, of course, is Bartza Blog. You can Google that. And it's you really work hard on that, I notice.
It's
great. I mean, there's updates all the time. And
and it's not only opera. He covers lots of other art forms.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. It's.
I have opinions about everything, whether I know anything about it or not.
Well, it's always interesting. And John Jilks is here again. His blog is operaramblings.wordpress.com. And yours is mostly opera, right?
Yeah, it's pretty much all opera.
Yeah, yeah, all opera all the time.
And cats.
Yeah. Is that your cat, the little photo in there?
No, not the latest one. The ones that have accompanied... Most of the ones that have accompanied articles about critics have been my cats in a particularly critical mood.
Letting his opinion be known. And joining us today for the first time, really happy to have Lydia Perovich here. She's a writer and freelance journalist. She's written for The All, C Magazine, Opera Canada, Extra, N plus one, you can tell us what some of these things are in a minute, and Corriere Canadese.
The most obscure journals, yeah, in North America.
And her blog is definitely theopera.wordpress.com, and always interesting opinions there as well. And my name is Gianmarco Segato. I'm the Adult Programs Manager here at the COC. So I thought we'd start today. We've got several topics, hot topics to discuss today. And we thought we'd start with the recent death of Hans Werner Henze, one of the great European composers of this, I guess, the 20th and the beginning of the 21st century. He died at the age of 86 at the end of October and wrote a huge number of types of works, symphonies. He had a requiem, chamber works, but also many operas, two dozen, in fact, according to Wikipedia, and also scores for ballet, which I thought was interesting. He collaborated with Sir Frederick Ashton. And just as a note, tying it into the COC, his opera, Venus and Adonis, which I noticed is actually kind of listed as a ballet, there was a lot of dance in it, was presented here at the COC in 2001. So John has self-identified himself as the Henze expert, and we just wanted to discuss Henze, but also just where is contemporary opera maybe in Europe versus North America going, but we'll see how it goes with the conversation today.
Yeah, well, what struck me was that within two or three days, we got the announcements both of the death of Henze, but also the announcement that the Salzburg Festival was going to be doing a production of Harrison Birtwistle's Gawain, which sort of struck me as, you know, the bell that went off in my head was, well, here's the grand old man of European modernism, and there aren't a lot of them left, and they're likely not, even given the typical longevity of composers, not necessarily going to be with us all that much longer. And that got me thinking, you know, there's a handful of guys who were born before the Second World War, whose roots seem to lie firmly in the art music of the 20s and 30s, who've carried on that tradition. They've experimented with lots of other kinds of influences, and hence a particular experimented with jazz and pop music, and some of his music can only be described as lushly romantic, and for which he was much criticized by the European avant-garde in the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
Yeah.
But still, there's recognizably this tough musical tradition that operatically focuses on classic big stories. You know, Birtwistle's The Minotaur. Henze's written operas based on Phaedra, on the Bassarids, taking a classic operatic story, Manon, in Boulevard Solitude. Mm-hmm. And he's also written politically engaged operas. I mean, I'm one of the very few people who's ever seen We Come to the River, a 1976 work to a libretto by Edward Bond that's only seen two or three productions. And one of them I saw at Covent Garden as a very startled 18-year-old. I'd never seen anything quite like that before. I'm not sure I've seen anything quite like it since, to be honest.
Do you know that it's been remounted at Dresden in September?
Oh, that's...
So it had a really, really huge success there and critics have been commenting how what we once thought of as awful and disturbing and startling, how everybody loved him, actually. It was a popular opera, actually.
Well, this is, I mean, that's very interesting, because Ryman's Medea, which is also a tough opera on a tough, not just a classical thing, but a very disturbing classical thing. I mean, here's a, you know, a woman who kills her kids to get her own back on her husband. This is not nice stuff. Played to sold-out houses in Vienna. On the premiere, and you know, there's not that many contemporary operas played to sold out houses, let alone, you know, one rooted in serialism and classical myth.
Didn't Ryman also write an opera based on King Lear?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So another classic
sort of for Hans Genscher, what's his name? Dietrich
Fischer-Dieskau. Yeah,
right.
It's very good too. It's a very fine piece. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He uses a lot of classical texts from the Western literary canon and lots of canonical playwrights like Lorca, and he did something on Kafka's The Castle, and he did a couple of Shakespeare texts. So that's obviously libretto-wise, that's what he prefers, and I guess that's what the audiences recognize and like.
Yeah, which is, you know, such a contrast with some of the younger composers, and especially the North American operatic tradition, which is musically quite different. I don't quite know, you know, where I'd find the common points between sort of Glass.
Well, if we think of, especially, you know, some of the more recent operas, we've got Streetcar Named Desire, Andrew Previn, then there's Dead Man Walking, Jake Heggie, or some of the other ones based on novels, Moby Dick, the other Jake Heggie. I mean, I think when you proposed this topic for today, the first thing that came to mind was how different the musical worlds were of some of these European composers that you've been mentioning, and these North American ones. And I know it's sort of a different generation as well, but also the subject matter. And I just wondered, like, what you guys think about that in terms of, is there this difference between Europe and North America in that way? Or is it felt that over here people won't relate to these classical, so-called classical stories?
I think
there's
clearly a difference between continental Europe and the United States, where the UK and Canada fit into that, I think, is very, very interesting, because, like, on so many things, in some ways they look both ways. So, I mean, we had, I think, I don't know how commercially successful it was. I thought, you know, COC did Sarajevo's Le Mot de Loin, which is an example of a younger composer who's writing very much in the European tradition. And I don't know, I thought it was artistically tremendously successful, but
I think that score, you could definitely say it fits more into, like you say, the European tradition, even though here we are, we're watching it here in North America.
Yeah.
It had not much to do, I think, with the sound world of Jake Heggie and people like that.
It's a different thing if you go get a production that's from somewhere else, which is a whole different thing than if you're generating a project from scratch. Because I'm looking at, there are places where it seems there's a different set of assumptions behind what they're doing. I watched, by coincidence, speaking of modernism, I watched a production of Lulu from Le Monet last night. And these are the people, of course, we may recall in Brussels who were involved in that production of Semele. So some audiences seem ready to be challenged in a way that I don't think we're accustomed to here. So, I mean, those projects you described in the USA, Elmer Gantry, Dead Man Walking, Streetcar, Moby Dick, they seem to start with a subject that can be publicized. Dr. Atomic, there's another one, where it's, never mind the music, it seems to start with a topic and an idea rather than from a serious musical thing at all. And so,
yeah, no, definitely. It's like part of the marketing machine, you know, to... But if we're going to get people to come to these things, I think this is the thinking.
I mean, I think this is where Semele maybe ran aground in Toronto, because there was a different readiness for it, I think, in Europe. I think John and I agree. We're two of the only critics who really seem to love that production.
Oh, no, I didn't.
You didn't? Well,
no.
Did I make the wrong review? Sorry.
I was tolerant of it.
Okay.
Yeah. I like that. I was tolerant of it.
Fair
enough.
I sort of defended it because I couldn't understand the consensus that was forming about it as sort of a lynch mob consensus. In Toronto critics, everybody hated it.
I didn't hate it. I just thought some of the musical decisions that were made, particularly the ending, were I found difficult to go with.
Yours was a very reasonable critique.
At least you gave it a
this
chance.
This is all yeah, probably going to be edited out then.
No.
But,
no,
I mean, but you see my point, though.
Discuss away, please.
We're the radical fringe here who actually gave it a chance. There are some people just weren't willing to give it a chance. Mm-hmm. I think that's very different from the European experience. I think that's what we're talking about. And also at the Met as well, where, I mean, that ring was not so odd, nor the Traviata, but people gave them such a hard time over really conservative productions.
Well, actually, that kind of leads us, well, I mean, we've just had the premiere of Thomas Addis's The Tempest at the Met. I don't know, did anyone see the HD here?
Yes,
you did. Okay. And where does that, in terms of what we're talking about, where does that piece fit into this North American versus European?
I think it kind of straddles.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, it's Shakespeare, although for some bizarre reason, they decided to rewrite it in modern English in rhyming couplets.
Yeah.
Somebody should have shown them the libretto for Midsummer Night's Dream before they did that. The argument being that pentameters are hard to sing, but if you've the vocal line that Addis gives his singers is so horrific that the pentameters would just not even register on the difficulty scale.
I didn't understand why that Lee Hoiby wrote a version of The Tempest, which has been anthologized. There's some lovely music that tenors and a few others find in the aria books, and I've been waiting to see a production that's by an American composer. Mm-hmm. I was so surprised when they just kind of shoved him aside.
I think in Canada, the Victoria Opera Canada Opera Company Victoria did it. Yeah, a few years ago.
There's some lovely music in there, and it's intelligible. I think that's closer to Shakespeare.
I mean the music for this version of The Tempest. I think it's a really interesting score. It's complex. It's lyrical. It's got some, unlike a lot of, if I had one critique of a lot of modern operas, is they have really interesting orchestral writing and ditchwater dull vocal lines. You can't say that about The Tempest. It's got really, really interesting vocal lines, but some of them are horrendously difficult. I mean, the part of Ariel is set so high that, you know, I mean, I think it would have, you know, you couldn't take a cat to see it.
But in its sort of obvious choice, Ariel would be high, Miranda would be high, and
this is incredibly high. I mean, like nothing I've ever heard before. I mean, it makes the coloratura in the Queen of the Night sound like basso profundo.
I mean, pretty well every review I read and anything I've read about this opera, they always criticize the vocal writing for Ariel. They say, you know, it's just so ridiculously high.
They
can't understand any words.
The story has changed slightly. Prospero has a different attitude to the kids. This is actually a different Prospero. It almost reminds me of what Boito and Verdi did to Othello, where you make Iago more evil. And Prospero seems to be a nastier guy.
Oh.
He's much more much more affable in the romance of Shakespeare than he is in this libretto.
I sort of decided to sit this one out because I sort of had enough of Shakespeare texts. So why don't contemporary composers do other stuff in addition? I mean, The Tempest has been seen in so many editions and so many versions, and the film and the latest Met pastiche. It's just, no, it didn't. And it sort of looked like it's a sort of an exercise in escapism, and it didn't interest me. That. Recently, BBC journalist Tom Service wrote a book of interviews with Addis. Is that how you pronounce his last name?
I think so, yeah.
In which he comes out as really nasty gossip. He just disses other composers.
Wagner.
The dead one. Peter Grimes is rubbish. Dameronga makes him think of the Nazis. Verdi is all animal cunning, no brain, and so it's inflammatory things. So I don't know why they publish books like that.
Sort of interested, and we can just talk about this for a second maybe, is they've just premiered, I don't know, we keep talking about the Met, but they are the monolithic company in North America. There seems to be no getting around it. But I brought them up again because they've just opened a new production of Un Ballo in Mascara, and the director is David Alden. And given what's going on at the COC these days, it's the Alden boys all the time. We've just had Christopher Alden's production of Deflator Mouse, and coming up in the winter when we'll have Christopher Alden's Clemenza di Tito, and then in the spring, finally, David Alden's Lucia di Lammermoor from English National Opera. And I've read a few reviews of this new production. I mean, it sounds interesting, but it was booed vociferously on opening night, apparently, and the production team, and it's like the Met's trying. They're trying to, edge their way towards more maybe contemporary production styles. But
is this the first David Alden for the Met?
Yes. And that's the other thing. I mean, he's in his 60s now. I was surprised. I mean, Christopher and David Alden are twin brothers, right? And they've had, huge success, multiple productions all over the world. But often when you read interviews with them, they say, but in North America, especially in the United States, and we don't get much work, and this is
New York City Opera hires Chris.
Yes.
And Chicago Opera Theater.
Yes.
Yeah. So what is it with the Met? Is it just this deep conservatism in the audience, do you think?
It's not just the Met.
It's the Met,
I mean, the United States is a deeply, deeply conservative country.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, forget it. in general, I mean, it's socially conservative by advanced industrial economy standards. It's economically conservative, and it's artistically conservative. And when you layer on to that a funding model that basically means your productions are funded by rich people,
I think that's where the reason lies. If you depend on millionaires to fund your productions, of course they'll have preferences for the sets, and they won't like transgressive productions. They like what they have seen before.
I mean, somebody once described the Met as money set to music.
But are the rich people the ones who are really complaining? I'm wondering. I mean, I don't.
No, not necessarily.
I guess they don't have to complain. They just signal, I'm not going to.
But
you see, COC has donors who underwrite productions, and they're nothing like this. They're not conservative. I mean, the Alden productions get underwritten by donors as well, and it's all good.
Bad publicity. You know that old adage, there's no such thing as bad publicity. Hasn't it worked well for the Traviata and the Tosca that originally got booed on opening night but then did really, really well throughout their run?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like what happens at Bayreuth when people scream and yell on opening night.
Yeah.
Take it to the
heart. I mean, a lot of it is this initial reaction,
I mean, where
will die down.
Where it gets really difficult, I think, in the U.S. is when you try and do anything that's like a critique of capitalism. I mean, L.A. Opera did The Rise and Fall of the City of Mahogany, but it was so tame. I mean, because honestly, how do you parody capitalist excess in Los Angeles?
And the ring cycle design also was edgy Brechtian designs that had... I think Albert kind of looked like a capitalist. He was carrying money bags practically. It was this over-the-top... Well, of course, there were people who objected to it because it just looked so strange. It was Achim Freuer.
Oh, with the big...
Oversized
that's
images.
That's
beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there were people freaking out the first time they saw that, too.
Well, there was also a lot of financial problems in the end, I think, because it was so expensive. Yes. Yeah. Oh, boy.
But I was reading Alexander's Twitter feed the other day, and he was tweeting from the general manager tour.
Yes,
speaking of donors,
yes.
And he said, "Well, we're finishing off with drinks at the Alden's condo."
Yeah.
I'm thinking, why didn't he take a photo? Do they look like German expressionist films? Like a dreamy, slightly nightmarish apartment. What?
But I was just speaking with a colleague, actually. And I think they had a great time, and it was very successful. And she was saying how it was just amazing. They were in this amazing loft, and there were the posters of all Christopher Alden's productions up on the wall, and Sandra Rabanowski lounging on one end of the couch, and Isabel Leonard on the other. And,
nice.
Yeah, I mean, it must have been a fun evening, but But anyway, I mean, just interesting. I mean, the Alden's productions, I mean, have been even controversial here,
Yeah.
I'm glad.
There are critics here who, if you move the time period of the piece by a week, We'll go completely ape on you. I mean,
yeah. They're getting better, and I know who we're talking about. But one critic has surprised me regarding Alden. So I don't know if we can credit Amber for that, for the conversion of what happens. But
yeah.
who hated Rigoletto, he absolutely loved this one. So. Let's give them some time, I guess.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, the thing is, we're not getting what I would call the more outre directors. I mean, the Aldens are...
No, they're
pretty mild by European standards.
They are.
I mean, you know, let's bring in Calixto Bieto, for heaven's sake.
I vote for Herheim.
That would be awesome.
Well, we've got Lydia here, and as I mentioned at the beginning, in addition to being a blogger, she's a published author and... Very exciting event about to happen. She's got a new novel coming out called Incidental Music. And the launch is on November 27th at the Gladstone Hotel. And I was looking at the website. It looks like a really fun event. You've got some music happening as well. And maybe you can just tell us a bit about the book and your inspiration for it. It sounds like a fascinating story.
Well, maybe I just wanted a good excuse to spend a year immersed in opera. But one of the three principal characters is a retired opera singer who I'm trying to write through the roles that she played. So she had some unpleasant memories that she had. That are coming back, and instead of thinking about that, she ends up in scenes that she sung that sort of highlight her emotional states. So I spent a lot of time with various librettos, and you'll see which ones ended up being included. And at one point, I even go into the riff on Rigoletto. But all this is happening in Budapest, 56, and there's a connection with Toronto of contemporary life. And so the event itself, it's the launch at the Gladstone, will have the music part and the speaking part, like the old La Musica e le Parole.
Which comes first?
Well, since I'm Le Parole, I would say music always comes first. But, the first part will be singing sort of a Monty Python-esque history of the tumultuous relationships between mezzos and sopranos.
Oh boy.
In the history of opera. And then the second part is just an author interview. And we'll open with the film that I discovered that was made 1956 in Budapest. That looks so incredibly glamorous, and it's just complete recognizable Hollywood glamour. 56 in Budapest. Absolutely fascinating. So, yeah, it's going to be a busy night. Thank you for mentioning it.
Oh, no. I mean, we'll be looking forward to reading it, and I'm sure we can
do get... Do come.
I think it's going to be a lot of fun. Recently, I had a conversation with Nina Dugranic, who's the artistic director of the COC's free Noon Hour concert series, and she told us a bit about some of the upcoming concerts for November and December. Today I'm speaking with Nina Dugranic, Director of Programming of the COC's Free Concert Series, which take place in the Richard Bradshaw Amphitheater at the Four Seasons Center for the Performing Arts. Welcome, Nina. Thanks for coming today.
Glad to be here.
Now, the series is in its seventh season. Just in case anyone out there doesn't know, this is an incredibly popular series of free concerts, as we say. There are always long lineups. People get there early to get their seats. The series has a huge variety of artists. We have a vocal series, there's a piano virtuoso series, you'll hear jazz, chamber music, world music, and dance. And we're particularly proud always to feature members of the COC company. So we have several concerts with the ensemble members, that includes singers and collaborative pianists, as well as members of the COC orchestra. And that's a great part of the season. Now, I thought since you haven't been on the podcast before that we'd start maybe with a sort of general overview and background as how did the series start for those people that don't know?
Absolutely. Well, the series was born with the new building. Mm-hmm. Somewhere along the line in the process, Richard Bradshaw, our late general director, realized that we had this incredible opportunity to highlight and provide performance opportunities, not only for the members of our company, as you mentioned, the young artists and the main stage singers and the orchestra, but also for a huge variety of other genres and disciplines who might not otherwise be featured in an opera house. And that we had the opportunity to open this up to this diverse audience and to welcome people of all ages and backgrounds into our new building and to give back to the community in that way. And it was really important that this high-quality artistic programming be accessible to everybody, regardless of their financial means, regardless of their interests, and that people have an opportunity to discover and experiment and collaborate in ways that they might not be able to do in another venue. So it was really seen as a meeting point and a cultural hub for artists and for audiences.
Well, there's certainly nothing else like it in Toronto that I can think of. Even within a North American or world context, I don't know. Is there anything quite this wide-ranging?
There's nothing with the scope and diversity that we're presenting. So we really have created something very special and unique, I would say, in the world.
That's incredible. Now, I can't even imagine what it's like to program a series like this. This runs from basically September till June,
right? That's right.
And, I mean, there's at least two concerts a week, sometimes three. I mean, in a nutshell, if it's possible, how do you program something like this? What are the challenges of coming up with ideas and performers, et cetera?
Well, ironically, the challenge is not coming up with the ideas. Mm. The challenge is how to accommodate all of the ideas that I have and the incredible wealth of talent that we're blessed to have in this country and in the world with visiting artists into the limited number of slots that I have. So the problem is not how to find artists, it's how to limit all the ideas and, of course, how to work within, understandably, a limited budget and the resources and the schedule of the building and the artists and so forth. That all gets very complex, but there's no shortage of ideas, and there's certainly no shortage of talent, and it's a great problem to have.
So what are some of the greatest rewards or some of the highlights of your time programming this series for you personally?
I think really when I'm able to bring artists together who haven't performed together before, or when I can encourage an artist to go outside his or her comfort level to try something new, and they go with me, and then, you know, there's a whole long process, and in the end it all comes together. And of course, in those situations, and even in concerts where artists are not being stretched out of their comfort levels, but just whenever those transcendent moments happen, when everybody, the artists, the audience, are up, when time stands still and everything comes together, and those magical moments where the ones that we live for, those are always the most rewarding, and I think for the audience as well as for the artists and for me personally, we all share that reward.
Well, you certainly brought, I'm just recalling now one of the concerts from last year when one of our ensemble sopranos, Jacqueline Woodley, was singing. It was a contemporary work.
With electronics.
Yes.
Yes, that was quite a
I mean, that's certainly probably, you know, conventionally we have the soprano going up and singing the aria, and which is wonderful, of course, but this was something quite different.
Yeah, well, all the artists on that particular program really stretched.
Yes.
And it was incredible, the result. I mean, that was absolutely one of those highlights.
Definitely.
Where there were blood, sweat, and tears put into the process. But at the concert, it all came together so beautifully, in fact, that Sarriaho herself said that she had never been so moved by a performance of her own music than at that concert. And
well,
so
that's
the
highest compliment I can imagine. Now, the season that we're in right now is well underway. We've been having concerts now for a few weeks. And today you're here to talk about a few of the upcoming concerts in later November and December. So I'm wondering if you could just highlight a few of the things coming up for our audience.
Absolutely. Although I have to preface that by saying they're all my babies.
Of course.
It's like asking me who's my favorite child.
No favorites here.
I think just to give a sense of maybe, you know, some of the variety that's coming up. On November 20th, since we were talking about contemporary music, we have a very passionate advocate of new music in Brian Current, a composer and conductor here in Toronto, who has put together a fabulous program with the young artists of the Glenn Gould School New Music Ensemble. And they'll be performing a program, a really fantastic program that's called Playful Virtuosity. and they'll really debunk a lot of myths about new music being inaccessible or difficult in any way. This is really attractive, vibrant music. One piece by a superstar South Korean composer called Eun Suk Chin, a French composer, Martin Matalon, and a Canadian, Chris Paul Harmon. So it's a really wonderful program that features some really exciting solos and highlights the virtuosity of these really talented young artists. So that's one that I'm really excited about.
And Brian Curran and his ensemble from the Glengall Studio have appeared several times with you, right, over the years?
I try to feature them annually in the series because I think it's very important. And particularly for new music, people can come to this series and there are no barriers. They don't have to reserve in advance. They don't have to fork out $50 or whatever it is. They're much more open-minded and they listen to a concert like this and they say, hey, this is really cool stuff. I'm going to listen to more of this. And then, you know, hopefully they then convert it to the cause of new music. And we've opened that door for them. Yeah. So that's particularly rewarding. November 22nd, we have a very exciting new Toronto-based trio called Myriad. They're actually called Myriad 3 now, featuring pianist Chris Donnelly, who has performed several times in the series. And he came together almost accidentally a while ago with Dan Fortin and Ernesto Cervini. And the synergy between these artists and their creative scope and just the excitement of what they do and the originality and invention is absolutely spectacular. They describe themselves as jazz meets classical, meets pop, meets Oscar Peterson. And for example, their take on C-Jam blues is just absolutely mind-blowing. I mean, it's worth coming just to hear that. And they're just about to release a new CD and will be highlighting, this will be their debut CD and they'll be highlighting repertoire from that CD. And I think this is a group that's really going to be one to watch. So exciting, young, cutting-edge jazz trio. And then on November 27th, we have some very young artists, as young as 9 years old.
Oh, wow.
And these kids are so inspiring. They're artists who are part of the Young Artist Performance Academy at the Royal Conservatory of Music, and they are the best of the best. And I've heard some of these artists in the past, and they could give a masterclass on how to perform a legato line on the piano or, I mean, really an inspiration even to some of their much more established colleagues. An inspiration. And again, if you are the kind of person who likes to say, you know, I knew them when, it's really fascinating to watch their careers as they grow and develop. So we're looking forward to that on November 27th. December 12th, we have a very special artist, Alex Pangman, who is a singer who specializes in music of the 30s and 40s. Her latest album called 33 was released when she was 33 and featured a lot of repertoire from that year and that era. So these great classic tunes from the dirty 30s. She has such a knack for this repertoire, and she is on so many levels a real inspiration and a force to be reckoned with. I think it's known that she has battled her whole life with a lung disease that ultimately ended up in a double lung transplant, and she will be singing the concert with this new pair of lungs that she's still adjusting to. But it's absolutely phenomenal that she has overcome such obstacles, and is, even without knowing this personal history, she's an inspiration. But of course, when you have this additional layer, it just it's really humbling. And then our final concert before the Nutcracker takes over the front of house with countless matinees in December is by Zhengyi Korean Drumming Ensemble, who are joined by a zither player. And this is, of course, traditional drumming from Korea is always very exciting. And this concert features a very unusual and fascinating dance called the Ribbon Hat Dance, in which one of the artist's places a hat on his head that has ribbons that are about 15 feet long and does this the most beautiful dance where these ribbons just swirl around the space to the sound of the drums. It's absolutely breathtaking and I think a wonderful way to...
Yeah, it's a head out into the holidays.
Exactly.
Well, all this sounds so fascinating, and I really appreciate you coming in today to highlight concerts are coming up, and definitely would love to have you back again in the future to do this again sometime.
There's lots more to talk about.
Thank you so much for joining me today, Ina.
Thank you.
Well, this coming spring at the COC, we'll be presenting three operas, and two of them, Lucia di Lammermoor and Salome, and then the other one's The Dialogues of the Carmelites. But a story sort of caught my eye the other day. It was in the Herald Sun from Australia, and they're currently putting on Salome, Lucia, and Butterfly, Madama Butterfly. And this was an article which sort of sparked memories of a book that I read many years ago, Catherine Clément's opera, The Undoing of Women. And I think it was, you know, in the 80s it was written, wasn't it? I think, or late 70s. It was, at the time, very controversial. And her basic premise is that, you know, here we are in opera with all these female characters. And really what happens to them is, you know, horrible.
They're all killed.
They're all tortured. They're all under the thumbs of tyrannical men, which, you know, it's pretty well the way it is for many female characters in opera. Some critics of her book have said that, yes, this is all true if you look at just the libretto, just the stories, but in fact that in their own way, somehow the composers tried to empower these women through their music. So, I mean, the example I always come back to with that is, for instance, Lucia di Lammermoor has this horrible, all these horrible things to happen to her. She does go mad, but she has this mad scene. And I guess one could see that as her striking out and striking back. The story that appears in the Herald Sun sort of touches on these themes. And, you know, because they're doing these three operas, it's, I guess, a good time to revisit some of this. So I'm just wondering sort of your thoughts on all of this. And it's a vast topic, obviously. We could go on and on forever, but I'm interested to know.
I have a functional way of looking at it. Mm-hmm. If you think of the old dichotomy, especially in older operas, between action and passion. I was listening to Les Troyens. The macho action scenes are all orchestral. Same with Wagner. When men take action, it's the orchestra usually, you know, when you have the fight between the dragon and Siegfried. When a man is singing at length, it's almost unseemly. I'm not saying it's impossible, but it's rare. You have it in Tristan and when Siegfried is dying, when a man is dying. But women are privileged in a way as those who can tell us about their emotion. Hmm. So you think of the great characters like Violetta and Carmen, you know. For a woman to sing about her feelings is okay at great length. For a man to sing about his feelings, it's kind of like Hamlet. It's a little odd for a man to be verbose. Men are active, women are verbose and tell us about their feelings. So there's a natural cultural disposition to listen to women tell us about their feelings. It's a natural. I mean, I just think that's one reason why women suffer on stage, because it's an excuse to turn them loose.
Hmm.
There's lots of male solos. There's lots of tenors. There's lots of bromance. There's lots of male-centered operas, and I'm not sure I agree, but I do. I mean, it's an interesting debate, and books have been written since Catherine Clément, and people have tried to analyze why is it that composers have tortured so many sopranos, and why is it that the audience loves
grieve? Yeah.
So that's the old question. What, when you show somebody being tortured, oppressed, and so on, do you perpetuate it or do you actually highlight it as a process so people become more conscious of it? That's one question. And that's whether Freud is this similar, whether Freud is patriarchal or actually showing how the patriarchy works. So that's one of the defense that you can, I guess, put forth for the tortured dying soprano. But other people have argued, and it's similar what you're saying, that women have been, sopranos have been tortured in that way because the men, that gives the men the excuse to express their grief and to express their emotions. So if the partner has died, then we can have a male character who's...
It's interesting. One of the things that really struck me as looping back about Ryman's Medea is that Medea, in his version, is one of the few female characters in operating who really has agency. She runs the show in that opera.
So does Charpentier's Médée as well?
Yeah.
There are some. So let's find operas in which the women have agency.
There aren't very many.
No.
There are. I was about to say Norma, but I thought, no. I mean, Norma, a bit more, but she ends up... I mean, it's a decision on her part to, you know, kill herself.
There's also a voyeuristic component to it, so that when someone is singing beautifully about their suffering, we're not necessarily watching them hemorrhage or die. Sometimes there are really disgusting operas in the last 100 years where we're watching murder on stage, but often it's a long process of discovery and, you know, I'm thinking to handle so many of those arias are small chunks of people's grief or their sadness, and we will watch that, and there was something in the 18th century, a real fascination with tears. This was their version of pornography, to see someone on stage.
When you look at Bill Cantor, for instance, they have no plausible characters. Come on, let's be truthful, Bill. So, I mean, when Lucia dies, it's almost like watching the Punch and Judy show. They're sort of masks. They're sort of puppets.
Yeah. I mean,
does anybody really get moved by Lucia's mad scene?
I think it's a different thing. It's about the vocal display. It's you're moved by just the amazing singing, perhaps the sound of the melody. But I mean, having said that, something like Madame Butterfly, I find, does move me. I mean, not when she dies. It's other moments in that opera.
Well, yeah,
I mean, when she pulls out her child, when the letter's being read to her by Sharpless. I mean, it's very manipulative. I know.
Very.
But, I mean, it is, it moves me.
He is.
So what do you think his attitude was to his female characters? And did he, I don't know, did he despise them? Were they...
I mean, we are on their side, but why go through all that to get the viewer and listener on their side? There are other ways. I'm on the side of Médée in Charpentier without condoning her murders. And so. Mm-hmm. Well, there are other ways.
Remember, if you were to go to TV Guide, remember that old... Chestnut. You could always read the synopsis of what happens. You watch it not to know who wins and who loses, but to watch the process, to be fascinated by the way you get from point A to point B. It's the journey, not the destination. You're watching someone suffer. You're watching someone have recognition and with nobility and dignity go down in flames. But you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. We're watching this long process, especially in Handel.
I mean, it gets worse. I think it gets worse from Bel Canto on. From Bel Canto and Verdi, yes, have dying, lots of dying women. Puccini has lots of dying women. Wagner?
Not really.
No.
Strauss? No.
They die of mysterious, invisible causes.
Well, Zalme is when I was wondering what
and you... And Mozart's pretty feminist, avant lettre. So, and then Baroque is weird about gender. It's very transgressive about gender. So you don't really have women being killed.
So it's very much the 19th and late 19th century.
I think so.
And that, you know, that ties in a lot to just how women were viewed during that period, I think.
And there's certain other quality that Italian opera of the 19th century has. I mean, it's melodramatic.
Mm-hmm.
In general. I'm overgeneralizing, obviously, but it's clearly designed to appeal on a particular emotional level to a particular kind of audience, and it still does.
Well, I'll be interested. I mean, when we have Lucia in the spring, the David Alden production, you know, it is supposed to be, I guess, a little bit transgressive. It's not going to be your standard Lucia, so we'll see how he handles it.
It's why I loved Alden. The other Alden's Rigoletto. It was all about Victoriana and its oppression of women.
It was actually very redemptive in a way for women because it kind of took the whole question of blame out of the equation. Mm-hmm. It was this machine, that society, that kind of you were trapped.
Well, it's been a fascinating conversation today. Thank you very much for joining me, Leslie and Lydia and John. And
Thank you.
Hope to have you all back soon. This is another podcast from the COC sponsored by DECA, the opera label.